On the program today, a brief discourse on inflation. More interesting than it sounds, I promise. Also, the economic realities at the heart of Miss Juneteenth. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today, the 8th day of February. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. While Congress and the White House continue to parlay over what exactly they are going to do about another round of virus relief, President Biden's $1.9 trillion plan specifically, we are going to talk about the economics of it.
My predecessor, you know, has indicated that there's a chance that this will cause inflation to rise. And that's also a risk that we have to consider.
That was, of course, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on CNN this weekend, responding to an op-ed by former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who said that $1.9 trillion is too much relief, in part because it might cause inflation, to which Yellen said this.
I've spent many years studying inflation and worrying about inflation. And I can tell you, we have the tools to deal with that risk if it materializes.
I will pause here only to note that a recent song about Dr. Yellen literally started with the attention she has paid to inflation over the years.
Oh, who's yelling now? Who's yelling? Who's yelling now?
Doves on the left, hawks on the right, crosstalk in the flock trying to fight mid-flight. But here comes yelling.
Man, I love that song. Hawks and doves, that's all about inflation, right? But anyway, why, after years when inflation was subdued at best, are people worried about it now?
The concern is that if government spending rises very rapidly, you'll have too much money chasing too few goods and services out there, and that will push the prices of goods all up together and cause inflation.
Erica Groshen used to be the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. She's at Cornell now.
People don't like it, mostly because it adds uncertainty into their lives.
Well, if you're a borrower, it'd be bad news because the interest rate on your loan could go up if it was variable, or if you're thinking about, say, buying a house, mortgage rates could be higher.
That's Stephen Fazzari. He's a professor of economics and sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. The best part of this whole thing is that Secretary Yellen and the Treasury Department don't really have a lot to do with controlling inflation right now.
The Federal Reserve takes primary responsibility for reining in inflation. So if they started to see inflation bursting out, they could raise interest rates, and that would discourage borrowing and spending. So that would cool down the economy.
And with rates at basically zero now, the Fed's got some room. But it's tricky, right? The trillions of dollars being put into this economy now is a big deal, possibly inflationary. The Fed could raise rates if things get bad. It would slow the economy down. But inflation hasn't really been a thing for years. How do I know that? Well, here's me and then former Fed chair, not yet Secretary Yellen, during an interview a couple of years ago.
And you have famously said, I'm paraphrasing here, I don't know what's going on with inflation, right? I mean, you're smiling.
A little more extreme than I probably would have put it myself.
But you said you can't figure it out, right?
There's less inflationary pressure than I would have expected in a labor market this tight.
Much like debt and the deficit, chances are real, real good. You're going to start hearing a whole lot more about inflation as the politics of more help for this economy start getting heated. So now you know. Also, you should listen to that whole song about Yellen. It's really good, and it's on our website. House Democrats, we are told in published reports, are set to introduce a plan to increase child tax credits for American families up to $3,600 per kid, available monthly, phasing out, of course, for higher income parents. Last week, paid leave legislation was introduced as well. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, elections do have policy consequences.
Low and middle income families have taken the pandemic downturn on the chin. Many parents have lost jobs and income, says C. Nicole Mason at the Institute for Women's Policy Research.
In this moment, cash matters. Giving families the tax credit in advance or monthly would go a long way to lift families out of poverty and allows them to be able to make ends meet.
But extra cash won't help much if parents can't get back to work. And women, especially those with children stuck at home now, have lost or left work at unprecedented levels. Women's workforce participation is at its lowest since the late 1980s, says Emily Martin at the National Women's Law Center. She says a key priority for helping them is to include aid to states and cities in any new COVID relief package.
Because women are primarily the workers in state and local governments. So when they have funding cuts, women lose their jobs. And it's also because state and local governments make sure that, for example, schools have the resources they need to reopen safely.
How about preschools and childcare centers? Indi Duttagupta at Georgetown University's Center on Poverty and Inequality says in spite of PPP small business loans and other government aid, many of these centers have closed down.
Right now, we assuredly need tens of billions of dollars, probably 40 plus, to help sort of stabilize the childcare sector and put it on better footing.
Finally, with Democrats in control of Congress and the White House, a national paid family and medical leave law seems more likely than ever to pass. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The good news is that we are vaccinating more people now for the virus. The bad news is that those vaccinations seem to be coming at the expense of testing. Now, with no small number of people deciding not to get the shots, and with new variants of the virus spreading, we are going to have to be testing for a good long while to come. So testing experts are getting creative. And among the ideas, combining samples to screen lots of people at once. Marketplace's Scott Tong visited a school in Washington, D.C. that's trying it out.
Once a week at Washington International School, more than 1,000 students, teachers, and staff members line up for COVID testing. Right now, a bunch of first graders is standing in the hall, reasonably still, and a boy named Joshua steps up.
So they put a swab in your nose, and they turn it around. They spin it in, and it tickles.
He tromps over to the school nurse, who sticks a swab up his nostril and counts.
8, 9, 10. All right, take a break. Oh, bless you.
And then the other nostril.
9, 10. All right, you got it, buddy. Good job. Cover your mouth.
A bunch of samples get combined into a single vial of clear dilution liquid, and that's the key. This is pooled testing, where several samples get tested collectively. School nurse Jamie Zeich drips the group sample into a palm-sized purple box. It's a portable PCR testing machine that's accurate and speedy.
We plug this in for about 27 minutes. If it's negative, we'll get a purple line right here. And then if it's positive, we get two lines.
Pooled testing lets the school monitor lots of students and teachers who have no symptoms but could be carriers. And it's affordable. Dr. Ethan Burke, Chief Public Health Officer at United Health Group, designed this testing pilot.
We could get, on average, about 7 to 8 people per test every week. And that just gives us a huge efficiency gain in terms of resources and costs.
Here's the catch. If one pod tests positive, every kid in that pod has to get sent home and has to schedule an individual test. It's a pain. But the greater good is that the school can remain a COVID-free zone.
So it's a little less about diagnosing the individual and more about keeping the school and the community carrying on. And that would apply to a business or a factory or a flight crew as well.
The economic argument is that mass testing can keep schools open, letting more parents get back to work. But it was a dicey sell at Washington International School because there's no professional lab involved, says school nurse Molly Foa.
I was a little skeptical as to kind of who was going to oversee it, what was going to happen if we were kind of new in the process. And it has been a huge surprise to me that it has run as smoothly as it has.
Pooled testing does have its limits. In places where the pandemic is raging, lots of pools would be positive and require follow-up tests that drain scarce testing supplies, like special chemicals and plastics. Romney Humphreys directs the clinical microbiology lab at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where she says nearly 18% of COVID tests turn out positive.
At a positivity rate that high, there's no value in pooled testing.
And she says big labs, already overloaded with COVID testing, aren't set up to combine samples and combine names and track it all.
To be honest, as a lab director, it's a little bit scary to me because the logistics of managing that is pretty challenging. And every time you introduce these complexities into your testing process, you introduce opportunities for error.
Have you had this done before?
Yep.
All right.
So for now, pool testing remains a pilot at places like Washington International School, where first grader Olivia is in the swab chair, making a cringy face.
It tickled and made my nose and made my eyes watery.
Because it goes all the way up your nose and it's almost like you're going to cry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Turns out that on this day, the school had its first positive test since it began pooled testing around Thanksgiving. It was a group of adults. And follow-up PCR tests revealed it to be a faculty member who then had to go home. The school managed to stay open. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm giving away the plot here.
Nah, no spoilers here. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 237 points today, about 0.7%, closed at 31,385. NASDAQ picked up 131, 0.9%, 13,987. S&P 500 advanced 28.7%, ended at 39.15. This next item, it's kind of a Venn diagram of Reddit curiousness plus crypto plus good old Elon Musk. A cryptocurrency that has basically started as a joke in 2013, it's called Dogecoin, has been a topic of discussion on the Wall Street Bets forum on Reddit and has been rising after some promotional work from Tesla's leader in recent days. Today, also, Bitcoin ascended after Tesla reported it bought $1.5 billion worth of the stuff. Tesla now at like $44,000 per BTC. Tesla also said it's planning to accept Bitcoin as payment for its products. Tesla shares up 1.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One hates to be the bearer of bad tidings, but tax season officially starts at the end of the week. The Internal Revenue Service starts processing 2020 returns this coming Friday. It's later than usual. And given the way this economy went for much of 2020, the tax year in question, of course, it's going to be messy, especially for people eligible for this next round of relief checks, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Many people who lost their jobs in 2020 because of COVID still haven't gotten any stimulus payments. That's because the first two checks, at least initially, were based on pre-pandemic income from 2018 or 2019. Those people can get their checks now, says Chris Cox at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
Anybody who didn't receive their initial stimulus payments should file a 2020 tax return in order to claim their payments from March and December last year.
Whether the next round of stimulus payments, the one Congress is debating right now, will be based on 2020 returns will depend on the legislation, says Janet Holtzblatt at the Tax Policy Center.
But if it's set up the same way as the first round of payments were last spring, then it will be based on the possibility of two different years.
So either 2019 or 2020, depending on which year you filed most recently. Francine Lipman is a law professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She says Congress will likely try to get the IRS to process the next round based on people's 2020 returns.
But if you just look at the timing, it's going to be difficult, right? To process 180 million tax returns.
And try to get millions of stimulus payments out based on those returns. Janet Holtzblatt at the Tax Policy Center says there's no guarantee for people who are hoping to get a stimulus check based on their 2020 income.
But there is a way to increase your odds. And the way that you increase your odds is by filing electronically.
And, she says, by filing as early as you can. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Don't know if you saw this one the other day in the Wall Street Journal that Kraft Heinz is looking to sell off Mr. Peanut. Planters is on the market, part of a growing strategy among big consumer brands to focus on their top sellers as store brands grab market share. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at the rise of generics and why shoppers love them.
Mary Rysdale is a careful shopper. She compares unit cost instead of sale price. She drives an hour from her house in Southern California to go to Costco. And she prefers store brands. But there's one item she won't skimp on, toilet paper.
I have certain brands that I really like. And unfortunately, my politics of choice don't always follow what my tush wants.
A lot of you sent me tweets and emails today saying you love copycat products from Trader Joe's and Aldi, but there are also a few brand name products you, or specifically your kids, can't live without. Phil Lempert at supermarketguru.com says cereal is one aisle where copycats aren't king, but he has some advice.
Buy Fruit Loops, then buy the store brand Fruit Loops. When you're out of it, then put the store brand in the Fruit Loops box, and the kids will never know the difference.
Lempert says copycat products are much better than they used to be, and consumers are noticing. Last year, the private brand industry grew almost 20%, while large national brands actually lost market share. That's according to consumer insights firm IRI. Generics are now mainstream.
That stigma isn't there that he can't afford the real stuff, so he has to buy the store brand. So it's really changed.
Katren Gielens, who researches retail and brands at UNC, says more people buy store brands during a recession. And during the pandemic, shoppers haven't always had a choice when shelves go bare.
Private labels always gain when people are forced to try them and then really update their belief system, which makes them stick to them.
She says private labels will continue growing, though they do need name brands to crank out new products to keep playing copycat. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
They get out of bed real early. I know they'd appreciate it if you'd listen to them. David Brancaccio and the gang on the Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. This February is the first Black History Month since George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police last Memorial Day. And there are straight-up economic stories we have done and will do about race and racism in this society. But today, we are going to do a little bit out of season, a holiday and a celebration called Juneteenth.
It's a day in which we commemorate in Texas the fact that our enslaved ancestors didn't find out they were free until 2.5 years after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation.
That's Channing Godfrey Peoples. She is the writer-director of a film called Miss Juneteenth, inspired by the real-life Miss Juneteenth pageants held, among other places, in her hometown of Fort Worth.
It's such a personal film, and this is really a vulnerable place to be because Turquoise, the lead character in particular, is based on the women in my life, the women from the community, you know, in my family, many of my own experiences, but most especially my mother, because when I was growing up, my mother was single for much of my life. And I just remember, you know, seeing her juggling her own dreams with that of raising children. And that had such a big impact on me, you know, just trying to watch her navigate her own dreams. And, you know, this community in particular is so special to me because it was once this bustling Black enclave of Black business and Black commerce, but today it's being gentrified.
And yeah, this is Fort Worth, your hometown, right?
Fort Worth, yeah. Fort Worth is actually a major city, but I think in the film, you know, I've heard that it feels like a small country town because this particular community is called the historic South Side of Fort Worth, and it's a close-knit Black community, you know, where everybody knows everybody. And I really wanted the film to feel like that.
We have had a lot of conversations on this program in the past year or so about centering Black women in this economy and what that might do for everybody. And it occurred to me as I was watching this film that this film literally has a Black woman at the center. And it is in no small part. I mean, yes, there are social challenges and there are child raising challenges and all of those things. But there are the through line for this woman, Turquoise, is her economic challenges as she tries to go about her life.
Absolutely. You know, I think as a writer director, really my approach is authenticity first. Mm-hmm. I would see my mom work several jobs and then became an adult woman where I did the same, you know, in an attempt to keep my dreams afloat. And later I became a mother, you know, and that opened a whole different world, you know, in which I had to navigate my own dreams. You know, you see Turquoise working at the bar. You see her moonlighting mm-hmm. in a job, you know, doing makeup at a funeral home. I'm giving away the plot here.
That's all right. It's going to make people want to go see it.
But it's an important part of the journey. And, you know, for Turquoise, she's there reconciling her own dreams. But a big part of it is making sure that her daughter has the future that she feels like slipped through her hands.
Huh, yeah. There's another part of this film that is a little bit tangential, I think, to Turquoise and her story. And that is just the overall theme of ownership and having ownership of, take your pick, your life, your responsibilities, who owns the bar in question. I mean, you know, there's a little soliloquy that the characters give about owning things. And I wonder what that meant to you as you were writing it, you know, as writer-director, as you said, this one's coming out of your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming out of my mouth, but I also feel like at some point I get to know the characters so well. This will sound weird, but they start speaking for themselves. Huh. And there is this idea of what ownership means and what legacy means. These businesses that you see in the film, just like the bar and the funeral home, they're businesses that are being passed down through generations. People are saying, we want to hold on to these businesses. This is our own sense of ownership. You know, they're making a choice to stay in the community, even though they could be bought out and move on. I think there's a small part of me as well that's a preservationist, because this community in particular, I've been shooting there for years. I went to the University of Southern California, and I went back to Texas to shoot my thesis film. And the main business, it was a bar that I used in that film. You know, it's like now like a craft beer company. It's gone away, you know, in that short little time. So I think a part of me is trying to hold on as well.
So are you, I mean, look, this film has been at Sundance. It's gotten all kinds of buzz. There's more coming for you for sure. Are you made now in the film world?
I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. You know, right. I didn't know I wanted to be a filmmaker early on. You know, that came to me as an adult. I really got interested in storytelling because my mom would take us to a small community theater in that very neighborhood. I later got into literature that centered Black women by like Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Gloria Niler and these incredible, you know, literary geniuses. And so those were the pictures that I had in my head. And I would later come to see that there just weren't enough films that centered Black women. And that's why these are the stories that I want to continue to tell. So I don't know what made means at the end of the day, Kai, but I want to continue to tell my stories. That's what I want to do.
Fair enough. No, I get that. Jenny Godfrey Peoples, her film is called Miss Juneteenth. Check it out. It's really good. Jenny, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
I've loved it. Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today comes courtesy of the Twitter feed of John Ehrlichman. He does Bloomberg Television up in Canada. Some of the companies that advertised during the first Super Bowl that Tom Brady played in, that would be Super Bowl XXXVI in 2002. Here's a list, and I'll tell you what, there's a chance some of you don't even remember these names. AOL, Blockbuster, Radio Shack, Circuit City, CompUSA, which has been gone for I don't know how long, Sears, Hot Jobs, also, and this one's a little sad, Yahoo. Kind of wild, right? Also, by the way, thus endeth the mentioning of Tom Brady on this program. All right, we got to go. Here is your beginning of the week moment of economic context from the Congressional Budget Office. Their most recent analysis of what raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour might mean budget-wise. Congressional Democrats and the White House are pushing for it. The CBO says, all other things being equal, raising the minimum from its current $7.25 an hour, where it's been since 2009, would cost 1.4 million jobs by 2025. That's on the one hand. On the other, since we're talking economics, it would lift 900,000 people out of poverty and raise income for 17 million workers in this economy. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.